You're listening to Conversations with John Anderson, featuring Jacinta Price.
Well, today's conversation is with a wonderfully courageous and warm and generous of spirit Australian from Alice Springs. And her name is Jacinta Price. Jacinta, it's terrific to be able to talk to you. We're going to talk about some really tough issues. But first of all, can you tell us a bit about you and your family?
Sure. And thank you for having me. I was born in Darwin in 1981. My parents were working as teachers on Melville Island and the Tiwi Islands at the time. So I guess for me, as a Warlpiri woman, because my mother's Warlpiri and dad's a white fella from Newcastle, good old New South Wales. My baby spirit, where we believe where our place of conception is where our spirit has leapt from the ground into our mother's belly. This has come from Tiwi country. I have crocodile dreaming from there, which is my personal dreaming. I have inherited dreamings from the desert, which are fire and rain as well. So I guess what that means is what we believe is that in the beginning, our creator ancestors created the land. They came down from the sky and up out of the ground. And as they travelled, they left part of their spiritual essence in the ground. And so we gain our personal spiritual essence from the creator ancestor, from the country that we were conceived in. So that's what gives me my crocodile dreaming, from the top end, which gives me connections to the saltwater country, but also to the desert in central Australia. But my parents lived there and also in the Kimberley and moved to Alice Springs when I was probably a three-year-old. And that's where I've spent the rest of my life. I've done my school there. I had my children there. I had my eldest when I was pregnant in year 12, in fact, and due on the date of the formal. But luckily for me, he came 10 days later. I've grown up in Alice Springs. I've spent a lot of time in remote communities. My mother's from Yundamu, 300 kilometres northwest of Alice Springs. I speak Warlpiri, not fluently, but I speak it in a mixture of English and I understand it being spoken. And the sorts of things that I guess I've grown up with are, understanding my culture. My family are very traditional. I've performed in ceremony as a child, but also understood, the parts of culture that aren't so lovely, if you like. I've grown up knowing that you have to be tough. You have to be physically tough. Women are quite ready to act out violently if need be when you're an Aboriginal woman. I've grown up seeing a lot of violence within my own family. I've got family that live in town camps. I've seen that all my life, and I've also understood that there are even members within my own family who have perpetrated violence and sexual violence. And there's this sort of, you don't speak about it. You just pretend these individuals are, good human beings and we get on with our day to day. And having grown up and seen that and knowing the devastation that's gone on just within my own extended family, I sort of felt I can't do this anymore. I can't sit back and not address these issues in an honest way. And I think it's really important that we're able to speak honestly and openly about really, really tough issues in order to resolve them, because so far ignoring them really hasn't done anything to fix any of those problems. And I've been a victim of domestic violence myself, which was a really big eye-opener, because despite many of the challenges in my life, despite the fact that I've been surrounded and seen a lot of violence in my extended family, I was never really victimised by it personally. And that didn't happen until relationship that I'd got into following the separating from my husband, my son's father. And I saw that unfolding and when it happened to me and went, I don't want to be part. I have never been treated this way by anyone in my life, and I really don't ever want to be treated like that. And I should be respected and loved, and I deserve to be. And I think, you know, being in that situation, also you have a lot of doubts. You have a lot of, well, how could I? This is somehow my fault. You know, the whole system of trying to go to police to get support. There is definitely, as an Aboriginal woman, I felt. You know, I was asked, are you sure you want to press charges? And to me, well, that's a no-brainer. Yes, of course I want to press charges. But I think because the impact of domestic violence is so widespread and it's so common, you know, there's this idea, well, she's probably going to go back to him. What's the point of pressing charges? That kind of attitude. And I was really taken back by that. And I thought, no, there's no way at all that I wouldn't want to press charges. It made me also understand the difficulty of what it is for women in those sorts of situations to feel like they're trapped. Particularly, I think, if you've grown up with a level of abuse and violence as a child, I think it's normalised to a degree. So when it's normalised, you don't have that same sort of drive, I guess, like I did, to go, I'm getting out of this situation. I deserve better than this.
Because you were able to, and I'm interested in this, break that cycle. Mm. And you speak very lovingly of those boys of yours. Mm. You were able to break the cycle and they've come out in a good place?
Yes. And they're, of course, the main reason why I wanted to break the cycle, because, I mean, I thank God that they weren't there to witness what happened to me. They were staying at my cousin's place at the time. And because I could see just how traumatic it was for them knowing that their mother had, knowing that I'd been through that. My eldest was about 9 at the time. And I just remember him being really fearful of, you know, he thought someone might rape or murder me, you know, following that incident, and was always sort of wary of, what are you doing now, Mum? And I didn't want my boys to feel like, you know, like I was vulnerable, like I could be taken away from them through an act of violence. And I guess I understood that feeling because my mother almost died of kidney failure when I was a kid, and I dreaded losing her and know what that felt like, to feel like, you know, Mum could die. She's fragile, you know, we almost lost her. I'd lost my brother to leukemia as well. He was 10 and I was 3 years old at the time. And so I understood how fragile life was, but I didn't want my boys to feel like they could lose me. So I needed to be strong for them and allow them to understand that this is no way acceptable whatsoever.
That's an interesting point, that emotional security.
Mm.
And we might come back to that. Can I ask a question that may be sensitive?
Sure.
Presumably, they, because boys tend to copy other their father figures.
Mm.
If it's a good model, they'll treat women with respect. Mm. I think it's fair to say that as a general rule. I think
yes.
The scientists and the medicos and the shrinks would agree on that.
Mm.
Or they'll follow a bad model.
Mm.
What happened with your boys? Were you able to secure opportunities for them to see men modelling good, respectful behaviour towards women?
Yeah, definitely. You know, that particular situation was, you know, directly relating to them. You know, with someone that was a new man in their life that was, you know, looking to sort of take on a stepfather role. But I went, nope, that's not happening. But I'd been able to provide, in their family, they have my father. Their father as well. I mean, their father, while our marriage didn't last, was still able to be there for them, which I think is really important, that they've maintained a strong relationship with their father. and continue to do so. And my fiance now, we've been together 7 years, and they have had a very strong father figure in him as well, and really appreciate him in their lives, and been able to model, you know, what it really means to be a man. You know, to be a man, you look after your family, you love your family, you protect your family. And so they've had that. They've had a really strong, you know, both of their grandfathers in their lives have been that way, as well as, you know, their own father and stepfather. So I've been able to, you know, ensure that they know who they are. They're strong in who they are, and they're loving and caring and thoughtful individuals, as well as they will stand up for those who are less fortunate. That's one thing that I'm very proud to say I've been able to instill in them, is the fact that you stand up for those who are less fortunate. And, you know, despite the fact that you might have gone through your own hardships and faced adversity, you recognise when you're in a privileged position, when you're in a position where you can support others. And you know, that's part of their nature and now as well. So, yeah, I'm very proud of that. To see that in my young men, yeah.
So, from where I sit, you know, I had 19 years in the federal parliament. I grew up with Aboriginal people and sat beside them in the classroom and enjoyed the company of many wonderful Aboriginal people. The enmity of many, too, who didn't like me, and I can understand why some of them didn't, frankly. And not only for me personally, but because I represented things that were tough in their lives and past misdemeanours and the way they'd been treated. But I find myself at the point now where I'm deeply troubled, because I deeply and passionately believe that all Australians have worth and dignity, that we need to try and ensure that everyone has a quality of opportunity, not of outcome. Because there'll always be people who'll be diligent and work hard and be resilient, and there'll be those who won't take advantage of opportunities, but they should have that same opportunity. Mm. And when I think of the challenges of the sort that you're talking about, I have to say I can't pretend to know what the answers are. The one thing I'm certain of is that many of the so-called experts who pontificate from the sidelines don't know what they're talking about.
Yes.
And you've been courageous enough to challenge some of that thinking.
Yes. And I think it needs to be challenged. I think it needs to be challenged all the time. I don't think we can progress or grow without, you know, being challenged. And when there's a lot of people with a lot of goodwill out there.
Yes, that is true.
And I think some people don't know how, you know, what to do with that goodwill, and quite often the wrong thing can be done without entirely understanding a situation or taking the right advice as well. And I think for those who, you know, stand on the outside and think they have all the answers, I think that they also need to be able to admit that they don't necessarily know what's going on, and they don't always have the answers. And yes, you can feel compassion for somebody, but make sure you don't, you know, allow that compassion to be played out in such a way that it ends up being detrimental to people. And I don't feel also, you know, I'm a big believer, I guess, in tough love.
Yep.
And that is the approach that I take. Tough love is about challenging people, and it's about challenging people to understand their own ability. And I think for people who don't challenge others and, you know, remain quiet and not point out where they could perhaps improve, or why don't you try things this way, or even ask, why do you do things this way? And then if they give an answer that doesn't make sense, well, why, you know, can't you see how that is detrimental? If you're not prepared to do that, then you don't have those people's best interests at heart. you know, for someone who's prepared to effectively lie to somebody to make them feel good about themselves does not have the best interests of that person at heart. And you know, a lot of people get really upset with me because I basically speak the truth, because it touches a nerve, because when I'm talking about issues of family violence, there is not one Aboriginal family in this country who isn't affected by family violence in some way or another. I mean, we are like Catholic families. We, you know, we have vast extended families. For me as a Warrawari person, there are over 3,000 Warrawari speakers, and we all regard one another as connected through a kinship structure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So our extended family is vast. But so, you know, and there's many, many people within our family who are dealing with alcohol abuse and, well, not dealing with it, surviving through it, and violence and sexual abuse. And, you know, I feel a sense of obligation and responsibility to my extended family and beyond and further, that I have to tell you the truth in order for you to be able to face that and do something about it yourself, because nobody else is going to do that for you. Something has shifted in that once upon a time, Aboriginal people lived in poverty, yes, but there wasn't this level of violence. There wasn't this level of child sexual abuse going on. And there are people in countries who live in poverty, who live in really dire circumstances, but they have a drive to send their children to school. They have a drive to want to improve their lives. So why isn't that happening now? And of course, welfare is a huge issue. It takes away people's drive, and it's taken away the drive for a lot of Aboriginal people. I mean, to the point where it's allowing them to, you know, leave their children in circumstances where they're being sexually abused and experiencing these high levels of violence. And the continuing argument is that we need to throw more money at Aboriginal people. Well, Aboriginal people, you know, they say, outsiders say, live in third world circumstances. However, they have got a disposable income that people in third world countries do not have. So we need to really look at that situation and go, well, you know, what's happening? We need to get people back into meaningful work. We need to get them to ensure that they're sending their children to school so their kids are learning the tools of the modern-day survival. It's really... it's not that hard, and it's not rocket science, but there's such a victimhood mentality that people are prepared to comfortably sit in and be a part of. And if you challenge them, well, then you're called a name, or you're the one in the wrong, or you know, you're a racist or a bigot, or in my case, a coconut and a sellout.
I think there's a really important point that arises out of that. As we converse, what comes through is that you've had the courage to speak out because you think it's important, but you're free, so far as I can tell, from bitterness and hurt. You've been able to rise above that?
Absolutely. I think it's really important to rise above bitterness and hurt. Otherwise, it can destroy you,
yes,
as we're seeing all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, my grandfather, my grandparents lived in the desert. They had none of the things that I have. No clothes on their back, no shoes on their feet, no running water, no readily available food. They lived this way, and it wasn't, they weren't living in poverty. This was just life.
Mm-hmm.
Naked in the desert, surviving on a daily basis, and surviving with a sense of humour and a love for life and a love for your family. And this is what they did. My grandfather was in his early adolescence when he first saw a white fella. And he also lived through the Coniston Massacre of 1928. And he fled, he and his, and the family that he was with, small group of family that he was with, they fled They knew where the killing was going on and they fled from that in order to protect themselves. He went through that, and he also at one stage was chained around the neck and marched through Wadri country through to Arunda country and forced to work as a labourer in the army. But he saw the way the world was changing rapidly. And his understanding was, you have to move with this change. You have to keep up with it, otherwise you won't survive. Now, he also understood how difficult life was in that back before white people came to this country, you were at war with your traditional enemies quite regularly. And humans can be brutal, of course. Killing parties would descend upon groups, you know, their enemies' groups, while they were asleep, early mornings, while they were asleep, killing anyone they could. When it came to infants, they would break the limbs of infants and allow nature to take them because they believed this wasn't a form of murder, this was nature taking care of them. Women were raped, you know, these were all human behaviours that, of course, we understand and have taken place throughout our world's history since humans came into existence. So life was really difficult. So I guess my grandfather understood that there were this new tribe of people that had come along, which happened to have lighter skin, and times were changing. And he decided to move with those times. And he was a senior lawman, as a Wadri man, who conducted ceremony. He looked after his family. He loved his family. He took care of my mother and her siblings and his wife and ensured they were looked after. And he did this through the ceremonial side, but he also did this and started to, you know, took on work. He took mail on camelback. He worked as a groundsman at the school. He worked as a tracker with policemen as well. And he rolled with the punches, if you like. He understood that the time was changing. So, you know, despite what my grandfather had lived through, he didn't blame white people in general for, you know, his circumstances, for what was happening to his people. He didn't even, you know, blame government. He realised that life was hard and it was difficult, but you had to be the one to make the most of it. You were in charge of your destiny, not somebody else.
The fact is that at the time that Australia was settled, well, there's interesting debates going on there in a moment, both of our cultures demonstrated at the same time nobility and depravity, good things and bad things. It's certainly true of the first fleeters. They came from the most powerful nation on earth at the time, was Britain. It was still engaged in the slave trade. You know, the dreadful business where powerful Africans would capture less powerful Africans and take them to the coast and sell them for a few trinkets, and those poor, unfortunate souls would be transported, dying like flies across the sea, and then sold into slavery where their life expectancy was very short. And there was a lot more unhappiness than there was joy. It was a truly evil trade. They were brutal to their own people. Indeed, on the other side, it was a time when that culture was starting to wake up and recognise, for example, that convicts could be rehabilitated. It's often left out of the story, but much of the motivation for sending people to Australia was to set up a new country where convicts could be rehabilitated and begin a new nation, a fresh start. Now, at the same time here in Australia, of course, the original Australians, understandably, were to feel very aggrieved by a great deal of what was to happen, especially, you knew, touched on things like the massacres, truly appalling, unbelievable that it could have happened. But as you say, just like the colonisers themselves, And just like you and I, they were a mixture of good and of bad. We all are.
Mm.
And one of the things I think we need to do is to climb off some of our high horses and say we have a shared humanity.
Yes,
we're
definitely.
All good, we're all bad. We're all capable of doing terrible things to one another.
Mm.
You've seen it firsthand. But we're also capable of great courage and great nobility and of taking responsibility and breaking the cycle.
Absolutely. And, there is too much emphasis on the negative as a country, I think, in Australia.
We've become very negative, haven't we?
We've become incredibly negative. And I don't know whether that comes from the fact that we're in a very privileged position in comparison to other countries around the world. So suddenly now we have to turn on our own. I guess part of my battle is saying to people, well, we're just human. Like, stop trying to divide us, you know? And it's almost like you know, I've become a conservative, you know? My family once, you know, we voted Labor. We were staunch Labor people. And we've, if you like, been pushed the other way. And I feel like as a conservative, I'm always trying to reach out to the other side and go, hey, you know what? We're the same. We're human.
You see some quite ugly racism
in
country towns especially,
with
the non-Aboriginal people saying it's all the fault of Aboriginal people. But here's the irony. Many of the elites today are making the whole debate much harder to have, because they're not blaming the Aboriginal people. They're saying they're victims and we whiteys are the problem.
Yes.
It's all our fault. Our culture's the evil one that's done these terrible things.
Yes.
And what happens with both of those, we lose our humanity and our understanding that we're actually all in this together.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And then dishonesty goes.
Yeah.
And you get virtue signalling, like let's change the date.
Yes.
Of Australia Day. From people who want to engage in symbolism for reasons of loathing of our own culture.
Yes.
More than, I'm being really blunt here, I think, a genuine understanding of what's going to make a difference for Aboriginal people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, of course, it is like a distraction, if you like. Well, we're not actually fixing any problems, so let's look over here to this lovely bit of symbolism that'll make you feel warm and fuzzy while we don't actually get to the crux of the issue and deal with it on a human basis.
Yeah.
And that's what frustrates me the most is that, you know, if you're a human and you've got white skin, you're not allowed to have an opinion on anything to do with anyone of dark skin. it's, you know, when there's so much goodwill out there for non-Aboriginal people toward Aboriginal people, if we get people of Aboriginal descent continually who are the, you know, in the elite of this country, who are turning around and continually saying, you know, it's all the fault of the white man, yet they themselves have had all this wonderful opportunity, have paved a way for them to, you know, become elitists in this country, and turn around and say everything's the white man's fault and I'm still a victim, but you're not actually helping the most marginalised Aboriginal people who are nothing but Aboriginal, who have their culture intact, who have their language intact. They are the most marginalised. And to turn around and say to all those people with goodwill, it's all your fault, that goodwill is going to fade at some point. You know, people are going to get sick of continually being called a name. And when they're there, they've got, you know, they've opened themselves and they're saying, what can we do to assist? Effectively, they're stopping any kind of understanding of what it simply is to be human, to help in the best way they can with these circumstances, with this situation. It's like, you know, it is far more important not to cause offence, I guess, than it is to address real issues. And people don't want to cause offence. People don't want to put themselves in the firing line, if you like. And I've had a gutful, and I'm quite happy to stand there while guns are blazing, because it's time the nonsense came to an end, so we can actually start to really, you know, address these issues on the basis that we're all human.
Terrific, insightful remarks. A comment, if I may, and then a lead into your thoughts as a question on something else. On Australia Day, it seems to me that the worst thing you could do for Aboriginal people would be to change the date. That might sound a funny thing to say, but I say it for this reason. I think we ought to work hard to make Australia Day a day when we reflect more on the good and the bad. If you move the date, you'll forget the need for an honest debate about what happened, because there were aspects of it that were noble, the attempt to rehabilitate people. And in fact, the sailing orders were very clear that the local people were to be treated with great respect. That was all in the orders. Mm. But then there were the utterly dreadful things that happened.
Mm.
The disease, the massacres that followed later, which were truly appalling. I mean, unbelievable. And it wasn't until after the Mile Creek massacre that anybody was really brought to justice for what they'd done. My point, though, is that the best thing we can do on Australia Day, in my view, is to celebrate the good things and reflect on the things that we need to learn from. That'd be my sort of comment.
Mm.
And then we come to the issue that you've just raised, which is, what do we actually do to make a difference? We've got to, I know I've said it before, a bit hackneyed now, but break the cycle. Of all the terrible things that I saw, and I did see a lot of terrible things in my 19 years in public life, was in your hometown, Alice Springs, the one that's most deeply seared in my memory. I was out there on business of some sort, and I walked home one evening after I'd been to a dinner with a couple of members of my staff, and outside the casino were lots of Aboriginal kids, and you know how athletic a lot of them are, and they're kicking a football around and moving with enormous agility and what have you. But there was a bunch of them sitting on a bench, and it struck me that they looked really pretty miserable.
Mm.
So I went over and had a yarn with them, and they opened up after a while. And I actually said to one of them, "Mate, are you really looking worried? What's wrong?" He hadn't said much. And he said, "Our mums are in there. They're blowing the welfare check." He said, "A couple of days, my mates and I, we're going to be starving.
Mm.
And then we'll break into the school tuck shop to get something to eat. And then people will say how terrible we are, and we'll end up getting into all sorts of trouble. Mm. What are we supposed to do?"
Mm.
And for me, that was a terrible moment. It just seems to me, and I suppose I'm asking your opinion on this, what we've got to do in this whole debate is switch our attention to the children, to the next generation. How do we break the cycle? How do we get a group of them through, like your children, but in much bigger numbers, who have grown up emotionally secure and well-nourished and well-educated? Isn't it time to say, let's stop talking about the rights of adults and painting them as victims without in any way diminishing the challenges they faced, and turn our attention to the next generation, the kids, the ones who can't speak for themselves but are actually most vulnerable and most damaged?
Yes. Well, again, it's... I think, you know, if we look at what's gone on in our country, there has been a stigma around, you know, removing Australian children who happen to be Aboriginal because of, you know, what's happened in our country's history with the stolen generation. And I think that issue has been conflated. I think it's not recognised that within the stolen generation were many other stories than the most popular narrative that we know of, that children were removed because of their skin colour. And, you know, pushed into assimilation. There were, of course, many different stories with regard to the stolen generation.
Many different stories.
And that's a part of, again, acknowledging our history in its entirety and not particular narratives. that's recognizing our history as human beings and not holding, you know, all white Australians responsible who weren't even around during that time for what happened in our history. And, you know, we need to get away. And what I see a lot now is the way the media use trigger words, you know, they use the term, I think because David Gillespie recently said that, you know, he believes Aboriginal children should be adopted, and I agree with him entirely. But then you get news articles that will say, well, you know, politicians want a second stolen generation. That does not, that's no way helpful for those children in those really dire circumstances who are begging to have the same opportunities as the kids who whose parents run these media organisations who can flippantly use terms like that in order to trigger an audience. They have utter disregard for these kids in those circumstances. And then those who are being driven by their ideologies are going to jump on that and use that as their focus instead of focusing, again, on the children.
Kids.
And these are adults behaving very selfishly, in my view. When one can't look within themselves to make change because of their own insecurities about who they are, that becomes damaging because there's children relying on these adults to be adults and put their welfare first. And I am a big believer that, you know, there's a segregation going on with kids in care, and Aboriginal children are treated differently to other kids. And this is a result of the Bring Them Home report. This is a result of the stigma attached to the stolen generation. And there's a reluctance to remove Aboriginal kids. They should be treated just like any other Australian child.
It's actually as though we have one law for non-Indigenous Australians and another suspended law, or the same law, but it's suspended.
Yes.
For Indigenous people.
Yes.
And it seems to me to be a gross injustice.
It is.
Against Aboriginal children.
It is.
Gross injustice.
It's the racism of low expectations. It's like, no, hands off, we're going to let these kids be in these, you know, horrible circumstances where, and we're not going to lift the bar to where, you know, it should be alongside other Australian children.
I knew five people, all of them elderly, a couple passed on now, who were removed. And as you say, all of their stories were different. Three of them would have said, one of them actually said, I say it through gritted teeth, but I'm actually glad.
Yes.
Three of them would have said they were glad. One of them had a full sister who was not.
Mm.
Both of them were well-adjusted and working well in their communities and they enjoyed wonderful family lives. It was nowhere near as simple. And here's the rub. We're going to this motivation where, I'll use the word, do-gooders sitting in ivory towers tell us what we should do for Aboriginal people and refuse to engage in what needs to be done for their children.
Mm.
I think their motivation should be questioned, frankly, quite often. Because I think one of the things that they failed to do is to give justice to the motivation of many of those who tried to help Aboriginal people and are then judged for having done it the wrong way when they took children out of different difficult circumstances or sometimes were asked by the mothers to take the children.
Yes.
That's forgotten.
Yes.
I'm not excusing it. I'm not getting into that debate, but I am saying we have been very judgmental of their motivations.
Yes.
I suspect that those young Aboriginal children we're talking about when they grow up, and perhaps the young white Australian children too who get to know them, will be very severe in the judgments they pass on us. We should not be so smug in sitting in judgment on those who have gone before us, because I think we're presiding over terrible injustices and terrible blind spots.
Yes.
And I'll say it. A very clumsy racism if we could only see the way we're really behaving.
Yes.
Am I being unfair?
Not at all. I know of a woman whose story I shared in the lead up to the whole Australia Day debate. She had sent me her story and said, please share this for me, because she was enraged with the way that protesters were so willing to pour so much of their energy into trying to tear down Australia, if you like, and not into caring enough for Aboriginal kids. She's currently in the process of taking to court the Child Protection Agency for not intervening in her and her brother's life. She experienced extreme brutality and sexual abuse before she was 6 years old and right throughout her life. And she's become an incredibly gutsy woman, but she should never have had to endure what she endured. And the agency knew what was going on. The notifications had been brought up for her and her brother, and they were never removed from those circumstances. They were left there because they were Aboriginal. And that is criminal, in my view. And, you know, it disappoints me when there are Aboriginal people elected into positions of power where they can be speaking out against this or speaking for the children, but they don't. They continue to toe, you know, a particular ideological line and a narrative. And I can't understand why. I don't know. Well, I know it's to avoid the sorts of criticisms that I've been exposed to. And it's probably because they think they're going to lose that position if they, you know, speak the truth. But it's all selfishly motivated, and it's got nothing to do with what's best for our kids. It is far too common than it should be. And I worry for the future. You know, we're not going to have these children growing up to be tomorrow's leaders. And, you know, having, right now, I guess that they are simply just existing. And in my view, that is not good enough. It's not good enough to just simply exist. These children should have the same opportunity as any other, you know, Australian child, any other average Australian child in this country.
Well, an emphatic amen from me. Mm. So, I guess we hear that there are big issues in Indigenous communities, but could we have it from you straight? Mm. How would you summarise the problems, in essence, that your people face?
I think the most fundamental issue is around violence. The fact that, you know, Aboriginal people are very ready to accept the use of violence, and that plays a huge part in family violence, because most of the violence that does take place is amongst family. And children who are brought up in these circumstances are already behind the eight ball. You know, women, you have the women who are suffering as mothers who can't fulfil their duties entirely as mothers. You have men who feel displaced. They don't feel like they have any worth or fit in this modern world. And this is a much more recent thing. And I think it came about when welfare and alcohol was brought in, and equal pay. That's a huge issue. All that happening at the same time. Because prior to that, men worked. So men aren't working now. They don't feel a sense of self-worth. There's violence going on in the home. And when a child is brought up in that environment, well, that is their foundations shattered, basically. So they're not going to do well at school. Education is a huge issue. And a lot of kids don't have parents who encourage them to get to school, to participate in school. But there's also the health issues behind that. A child can't learn when they are at school if they're sick, if they've got issues with their hearing. And all of that is a pathway to youth incarceration, incarceration and a continuation of a cycle, if you like. I've always argued the fact that we need to focus on family violence. It's not racism and it's not colonisation that are killing Aboriginal people. It is the violence. It is children growing up in violent households. It is for us to have to turn around and take an honest look at what we are doing wrong. Yes, we can point out where government has gone wrong. We've been really good at pointing out that. But we're not so good at constructive criticism of ourselves. And our culture has not allowed for this. This is something that the Western culture have been able to, it's part of the norm of a Western culture, constructive criticism, to be challenged in order to grow. And let's get our boys educated and understand, you know, support them through that so they understand their own self-worth. This will allow them to become the men we need them to be. So there needs to be an understanding of what's going on within our own culture. We need to dissect our own culture and we need to look at what is working for us and what isn't working for us. And although we've been confronted with other cultures and we've had a extreme change in a very short period of time and we're still catching up, we're now at a point, I believe, where we have a lot of other human beings with a lot of goodwill who are prepared to support us to make the change. It's like if you're dealing with an addict, no one can change that person. That individual has to change themselves. They have to hit rock bottom and they have to make the change in order to turn their life around. We as a people need to understand this. This is what's going on with us. We need to make the change ourselves with the support of our fellow Australians.
Jacinta, thanks so much. I think everyone who hears what you have to say will recognise that you've walked the talk as well as talked the talk. And your incredible humanity and courage shine through. I say that not just out of respect for you, but because it raises an imperative, which is that thinking and thoughtful people need to engage with what you're saying and debate the issues honestly, not just throw brickbats. So all strength to your right arm. And I can assure you there are a lot of Australians who are willing you and your people on to a better future.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Conversations with John Anderson. For further content, visit johnanderson.net.au.